Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software. Information on the web at mathworks.com.
From WBUR in Boston, it's Here and Now. I'm Gail Harris.
And I'm Bill Delaney. Coming up, an interim government in Iraq of Iraqis forms this weekend. But will it ever have real power?
Also, one doctor's attempt to stem the tide of AIDS in a country where 40% of adults are infected.
And they're called smart mobs, and they've got the World Wide Web in their hip pockets.
The mobs are smarter. They may not be wiser, but they're smarter because they are capable of organizing collective action on the street, just in time, just in place.
Another tradition bites the dust, the demise of the free obit.
And a review of a rather twisted new whodunit, swimming pool.
These stories and more coming up here and now.
The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. The Bush administration is being criticized for a statement President Bush made in his State of the Union address that said Iraq tried to buy nuclear material from Africa. The White House later admitted that the statement was based on false information. NPR's Don Gagne, traveling with the president on a five-day, five-nation tour of Africa, says the president responded to the matter today.
The president has a very simple message when he is asked, and he has been asked here, and other aides have been asked here as well, including Secretary of State Colin Powell. The president's answer, though, is that his speech, his State of the Union address, accurately depicted the threat, the danger posed by Saddam Hussein, and he says the war was the appropriate action. And he declined to answer a question as to whether or not anybody in his administration should be held accountable for misleading information like that being inserted into an important speech like the State of the Union in the first place.
NPR's Don Gagne traveling with the president. President Bush is praising Uganda for its success in curbing the spread of HIV. The country's anti-AIDS program is touted as a model for similar initiatives. During a visit to an AIDS clinic today, President Bush said his $15 billion package will go a long way to helping Africa fight the devastating illness.
We will support abstinence-based education for young people in schools and churches and community centers. We will provide comprehensive services to treat millions of new infections. Throughout all regions of targeted countries, we'll provide HIV testing. We'll purchase antiretroviral medications and other drugs that are needed to extend lives.
President Bush is on his way to Nigeria now. The World Trade Organization has ruled that U.S. steel duties are illegal. The Bush administration initiated the temporary duties last year in an effort to protect the ailing domestic steel industry. NPR's Allison Aubrey has more.
President Bush introduced the emergency duties of up to 30% on imported steel products last March. The administration argued the tariffs were in keeping with a WTO provision that allows for temporary duties to protect a domestic product from a flood of cheap imports. Mr. Bush was also making good on a campaign promise to protect the steel industry. But the World Trade Organization has ruled that the steel tariffs violate global trading rules. The finding comes 5 months after an interim ruling that also went against the U.S. The European Union applauded the decision and is calling on the U.S. to remove its tariffs without delay. But the U.S. is expected to appeal the decision. If this happens, the WTO's appellate body will have 3 months to decide if the decision should stand. Allison Aubrey, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to NPR News. The Coca-Cola Company said today federal prosecutors have launched an investigation of fraud allegations raised by a whistleblower in a lawsuit against the world's biggest soft drink company. Coke's brief statement did not provide any details but said the company would cooperate with the inquiry by the U.S. Attorney for the Northern District of Georgia. General Electric has announced a 14% drop in second quarter profits, but company officials are optimistic about the rest of the year. From member station WNPR in Hartford, John Dankowski reports.
GE Chairman Jeff Immelt says that 8 of the conglomerate's 13 businesses saw double-digit earnings growth in the quarter, including commercial finance, consumer products, and NBC television. But the growth was offset by an expected downturn in the sale of large gas turbines by its power systems unit. And GE's plastics business continued to take a hit from high raw materials costs. net income slipped to $3.8 billion, or 38 cents a share, from $4.43 billion, or 44 cents a year before. The results were in line with Wall Street expectations. Analysts had trimmed their estimates for GE's full-year results in June, in part because of the expected weakness in the plastics business. The Fairfield, Connecticut-based company recently agreed to a new four-year contract with its two biggest unions after a dispute over higher health care premiums. For NPR News, I'm John Dankosky in Hartford.
Enron's plan to emerge from bankruptcy as two newly named companies has been filed today. In it, the energy company's creditors would get 14 to 18 cents on every dollar owed. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 96 points at 9,132. The Nasdaq is up 20 points at 1,736. This is NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NTI, a charitable organization working to reduce the global threats from nuclear, biological, and chemical weapons. On the web at nti.org.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Gail Harris.
It's Here and Now.
Iraq will have a new interim government starting this weekend, 2.5 months after the war was declared officially over, and decades since it experienced anything even close to democracy. The new governing council is made up of Iraqis who have returned home, along with a broad sampling of Kurds, Shiites, Sunnis, Christians, and Turkmen. But for now, Washington and London will still have ultimate authority there. For more now, we turn to the BBC's Johnny Diamond in Baghdad. Hi, Johnny.
Hi there.
Well, Johnny, as you know, there are 1, 2, 3 Americans getting killed there almost daily, and also widespread unhappiness with the slow pace of restoring basic services like electricity. So is this decision to form a governing council more about taking a first step towards self-rule for the Iraqis, or is the U.S. trying to perhaps step aside and let someone else take the heat for a change?
I think it's an element of both. Certainly, the administration, the Coalition Provisional Administration, or the CPA, as they call it, they're very keen that there should be some move towards self-government. They also believe that when there is some kind of Iraqi voice, it will help isolate those who are carrying out the daily attacks on U.S. forces.
Well, will this interim government actually have some power, or is it mostly symbolic? I mean, is Washington still going to be calling the shots along with London?
I don't think it's going to be calling the shots, certainly as much as it has been doing over the last few months. I think this will have quite a lot of power. Note the phrase governing council. It's called a governing council. It was going to be called an advisory council, and it does have the look of a government. It will be able to nominate ministers. It will be able to dismiss ministers. It will propose policy over a huge range of areas. Now, there is no question that the buck stops with Paul Bremer, the head of the Provisional Authority. And there's no question that if the council comes up with a policy that he believes is against Iraq's interests or is against the security requirements of the U.S., then he will veto it. But that's been described as an exceptional circumstances by the coalition authorities. They really do think that this should be a government in the making.
Mm. And what about the fact that we get the feeling here, at least, that there's still a pretty large information gap there, that nobody's really going to the airwaves in Iraq to tell the people who's in charge and what the vision is for the future? Is this something that this governing council might do, and would it be welcomed by most Iraqis, or will they even know about it?
I think they'll have to do it, and I think you're right, there is an information gap. I mean, at the moment, let's face facts, most Iraqis are more concerned about the lack of security, the lack of electricity, sometimes the lack of running water, than they are about the lack of a democratic and representative government. But one thing flows from another. Certainly, I think that the council, when it's formed, will want to make a very big impression with whatever media exists. There's an awful lot of newspapers, for instance. There may not be that much broadcast media, but there's a lot of newspapers. And remember, all of these groups are drawn from parts of society. They will be going back to those parts of society and saying, look, here we are, we're now in government. And that will be one mode of communication. At the same time, I think you're right. I think there is a problem about saying, here is a government, here is your government. And that's something that everyone here, the new governing council, and certainly the coalition provisional administration, will want to try and get that message out.
So if nothing else, perhaps it'll give the average Iraqi a chance to, you know, take a deep breath and say, well, you know, maybe we need to be patient for a bit longer here.
It may be that, or maybe it'll just give them a chance to moan about someone other than the Americans. And that, I think, is something which the administration wants. They want people to complain about their government rather than complaining about America and Britain.
Well, Johnny, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Johnny Diamond is a correspondent for the BBC. He joined us on the line from Baghdad.
Again today, for the fourth time in as many days, President Bush told an African audience that AIDS is the deadliest enemy the continent has ever faced, and that the United States would help confront the crisis. In Uganda, the president toured the Support Organization Clinic, Africa's oldest and first AIDS hospital. Nearly 29,000 patients passed through it last year alone. It's a measure of AIDS ferocity in Africa that Uganda's considered a success story there, having lowered transmission rates. Still, a million of the country's 24 million people are HIV positive. Joining us to discuss the state of AIDS in Africa is former New York Times reporter Phil Hiltz, who's currently living in Botswana, where 39% of the adult population is HIV positive. Phil's currently writing a book about AIDS in southern Africa, and welcome, Phil.
Thank you.
30 million HIV positive in Africa. President Bush has pledged, as you know, $15 billion over 5 years. But how much difference do you think that money will make in changing the behaviors that cause HIV infections?
It could make a very big difference. It depends on how it's spent. It's difficult out here to just expect to take the money and build a program and make it work because the culture is different, the situation is different, and, of course, the crisis is very great. In Uganda, at the beginning of the epidemic, about 18% of the entire population was affected. It's dropped down to 8% now.
And why?
And the difference and the difference is the change in behavior. And they've watched the amount of sexual behavior going down, more abstinence, fewer partners, partly out of fear. Condom use is way up, partly out of the program that they built there. The government was open and worked on it for quite a while. Now in Botswana, things are just starting. This is the second wave of the epidemic. It started about 10 years later here. And now Botswana is the highest rate in the world. And the issues, again, are the same. They're behavior change. The people here are still mostly in denial, and the government is working on it, but they have to build the programs that will help change the behavior the way it was in Uganda.
Is it your sense that the $15 billion will emphasize the sort of education that can change behaviors?
If you start out and you assign a certain percentage of money, say 30% has to be abstinence, that would be a mistake. What you want to do is you want to come into the country and see what's needed and spend the money as it's needed, where it's needed. So if it's done that way, and there's a program here now that is run by the government of Botswana, the Merck Pharmaceutical Foundation, and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. They've put in $100 million. They've brought a lot of experts. They have a comprehensive program, and they're working very hard on doing it just that way, going, finding out what the need is, and spending money exactly on that spot for the thing that works there.
Phil, you've been covering AIDS in Africa since the early 80s. How hopeful are you?
It's hard to say. In Botswana right now, things are quite hopeful because this country is the one that is got a comprehensive program. They're actually delivering AIDS drugs, Western-style triple cocktail AIDS drugs, to the people here free. And the bad part is we're still waiting for the people to come out and get tested. So most of the people who are infected don't know they're infected. It's no longer the situation that people thought it was where, there's just not enough money to pay for drugs in Africa. There is now. In Botswana, at least, probably in South Africa, several other countries, the money is there. But that isn't the whole solution. You got to get to the people. You got to get them to understand what the disease is and have them come out and be tested. So still, it's not clear what's going to happen.
Phil Hiltz, thank you so much for joining us on this.
All right. Thank you.
Phil Hiltz is a former New York Times reporter. He's currently writing a book about AIDS in Southern Africa. He joined us from Botswana. And now joining us on the line from Gaborone, Botswana, is Dr. Ndwapi Ndwapi, the assistant director of the Infectious Disease Clinic at the Princess Marina Hospital in Gaborone. And welcome, Dr. Ndwapi.
Thank you very much.
Can you paint us a picture of your clinic where 90% of the patients are HIV positive in a country where 39% of the adults are HIV positive? What is your greatest challenge right now?
Okay, well, our greatest challenge is just treating enough people. We're a small clinic. I think that on the standards of where we need to go, we started operating in January of 2002, so we've been in operation for about 18 months now. And in that time, we've been able to recruit about 4,500 patients, of which nearly 4,200 are on ARV therapy. And our response to treatment has been great. But, of course, you can imagine that the demand is way exceeds anything that we can provide for at the moment.
What does your clinic look like? Do you have enough beds? How are your facilities?
Well, we operate as an outpatient clinic. We've been fortunate enough in that we have had some charitable organizations, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, that have donated considerable funds for us to be able to build what we're calling a porter camp, which is basically a makeshift structure.
Do you have a sense that you're making progress, doctor, against this terrible scourge?
I think there's no question that if you go from treating zero people to treating 4,500 people in 18 months, you're certainly winning and you're certainly making a big difference. I think that what is more telling is that, of course, the numbers are much higher. Like in Botswana alone, we estimate that about 110,000 people actually need treatment right away, but we're only treating 5,000 or 6,000 so far. But I think that the benefit of this is much greater than the numbers that we're treating, because essentially what we've done is that we have changed the nature of HIV as a disease and the way it's perceived by our patients and the public in general, so that now it's no longer the death sentence it used to be.
You are receiving some wonderful support in Gaborone at your clinic. What about smaller places, smaller clinics in Botswana? Do they remain places where the challenges are overwhelming?
I think that so far in Botswana, we've designated four clinic sites, of which Gaborone is the biggest. And I think that they have had more problems with manpower, mostly manpower issues and just logistical manpower resource issues. But I'm quite confident that even though they may not have the capacity to reach the levels that we have in terms of the numbers we treat, we are quite confident that they will be able to contribute significantly towards treating people, getting people on treatment.
Now, President Bush has been in Africa all week, including in Botswana. He's constantly brought up AIDS and reaffirmed his pledge of $15 billion over 5 years to fight AIDS. Do you expect that to make a difference to you?
I think it absolutely will make a difference. We've started building an infrastructure around which we can accept this kind of aid and be able to use it efficiently. The larger picture is that I think that by the President of the United States committing himself to helping, I think it's going to jog the consciences of hopefully Europe and the European Union and South and countries in Southeast Asia that like Japan that are able to contribute as well.
Dr. Ndwapi Ndwapi, we want to thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Ndwapi Ndwapi is the assistant director of the Infectious Disease Clinic at the Princess Marina Hospital in Gaborone, Botswana.
Just ahead, they're called Smart Bobs. Are you part of one?
And later in the show, a review of a chilling new summer film, Swimming Pool.
There's more coming up here and now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Gail Harris.
It's Here and Now.
Smart mobs is a short phrase that describes the intersection of computers, cell phones, pagers, and people, now being used for everything from organizing protests to running political campaigns to terror strikes. Supporters of Democratic presidential candidate Howard Dean have used smart mobbing, organizing themselves online, and then meeting in person. Dean's campaign has also relied on the Internet to raise money. Two-thirds of his funds were raised online. Well, the man who coined the term and who wrote a book by the same name is Howard Rheingold. He joins us from San Francisco. Welcome, Howard.
Good to be here.
Well, it's nice to have you with us. Help me out with the term here, first of all, smart mobs, because don't we usually think of mobs as being absolutely the opposite of smart?
Well, I use the term to describe something new that's really a threshold that's being crossed for something old. But something old is self-organized collective action. And the combination of the Internet and mobile communications makes a lot of different kinds of self-organized collective action possible. I really started writing Smart Mobs 3 years ago when I noticed that teenagers in Asia and in Scandinavia were flocking. We're all showing up at the same place at the same time from eight different directions because they had been using these text messaging, the SMS messages, to coordinate. And at the same time in the Philippines, over a million Philippine citizens peacefully demonstrated and, in fact, brought down a corrupt regime. And I thought, gee, teenagers, political demonstrations, what's happening here? As I looked into it, I realized that while there would be things like the Dean campaign and a lot of other very positive developments, not every group of people who self-organizes collective action have beneficial ends in sight. And I wanted to make sure that this didn't sound like another booster of technology book. Yes, I think that there's some exciting new opportunities here, but I also think there are some pitfalls. And in fact, the Nigerian riots around the Miss World contest about 6 months ago, people were summoned to those riots using text messages. So you can self-organize democratic stuff and you can self-organize non-democratic stuff or violent or non-violent. That's why I use the word smart mobs. The mobs are smarter. They may not be wiser, but they're smarter because they are capable of organizing collective action on the street just in time, just in place.
Well, let's go back just a moment on the technology, because many of us remember the Tiananmen Square demonstrations in 1989, and it was said at that point that the fax machine was the communication tool that could fuel a revolution. Is this really so different?
Well, of course, you know, people in Tiananmen Square didn't have fax machines on them. So I think what's important is that all of the information and communication capabilities that the Internet has brought us has become untethered from the desktop. We carry it with us. We think of them as phones, but they're really morphing into PCs and Internet terminals. And I think that that's a dramatic difference. To be able to organize things on the street as you go along rather than from the desktop is, I think, a dramatic difference.
Well, and it's fascinating to me. You just gave us a couple of examples from the developing world. So clearly this is not just in places like America that this is happening.
Oh, well, in fact, America is a little bit slow to catch on to this texting phenomenon. There's somewhere between 60 and 100 billion text messages, SMS messages, sent worldwide every month. And the U.S. is slow to catch on to this. We're just beginning to catch on.
And in terms of politics in the United States, of course, there are now two key websites, meetup.com and the website moveon.org, which just had a vote for your favorite presidential candidate on the Internet. Do you see these as a temporary blip or a true wave of the future?
I think it's like the personal computer was in 1980. It's kind of interesting toy, but what the heck do you do with it? Or the Internet in 1990, well, these kind of engineering geeks are playing with this thing, but it's not going to be useful for anyone else. I think over the next 10 years, we're going to see this is going to have an enormous influence on politics and everything else. You know, we've already seen in the recent elections in Korea that the person who won was behind 3 days before the election, the young cyber generation there, using a website and text messaging, managed to organize a get-out-the-vote campaign that tipped the election in his favor. So I think that what we're seeing with meetup.com and moveon.org is just the beginning of people using these media to self-organize. And after all, isn't that what democracy is supposed to be about?
Well, has it gotten to the point now where it really can put a presidential candidate in office, whether it's Howard Dean or perhaps presumably George Bush could get out his vote the same way?
I don't see television going away as the most effective way of propagandizing people. But there is now an alternative. It's not the only way to get news. It's not the only way to organize.
Well, in terms of the dark side here, I have to assume that terrorists could use this technology just as easily as everyone else.
Well, you know, I don't think that the hijackers on 9/11 could have done what they did without using the Internet and mobile telephones to coordinate their actions and their planning. So, yes, terrorists, criminals, totalitarian governments, they will be empowered by this technology like everyone else, just as was true of the printing press and the telephone.
And is there a way to counter that?
I think that, you know, the answer to bad speech is more good speech, and the answer to people doing bad things is more people doing good things. So I think the counter for it is for people to find healthy, democratic, and productive ways to use this new technology and spread that around so that we can dilute the bad stuff.
Well, Howard Rheingold, thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Howard Rheingold is a longtime observer of new technologies. His book is Smart Mobs, and you can find out more at our website, here-now.org.
Next time on Here and Now, a doctor who supports assisted suicide deals with his own terminal illness and imminent suicide.
And George Washington University rolls out a virtual red carpet for Saudi royalty.
Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, proudly supporting public radio and serving the community, on the web at MathWorks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Gail Harris.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, who gets the last word in writing an obit? Our editorial roundtable takes up the issue.
And director Francois Ozon's first English language film pairs a rigid British crime novelist with a young, sensual Parisienne.
Listen, Judy, I'm going to be frank with you. I need peace and quiet to concentrate. And since we share the same living space, I must ask you just to go about your business without getting in the way of mine.
A review of Swimming Pool, starring Charlotte Rampling.
These stories coming up here and now.
I'm Dolores Handy. President Bush and National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice say U.S. intelligence cleared that State of the Union speech that included now discredited information about Iraq's nuclear plans. In Uganda today, the president stood by his decision to invade Iraq. Rice said the CIA director, George Tenet, if he had misgivings about the information, he did not make it known. More on the president's Africa trip from Associated Press correspondent Mark Smith.
Pointing to its dramatic inroads against the AIDS infection rate and its program stressing sexual responsibility, the president called Uganda a land of hope in the heart of Africa. But after stopping at a clinic that treats AIDS sufferers, Bush said it's clear from his tour this continent needs more help than it's getting to fight the disease.
We want to join you in the war against the pandemic of AIDS. We want to be on your side in a big way.
Bush has launched a $15 billion plan for treatment and prevention both here and in the Caribbean, but AIDS activists say it's not enough. And in an embarrassment for the White House, a House panel voted to cut its first-year funding by a third. Mark Smith with the president in Entebbe, Uganda.
Officials say there is no cause for alarm after some people were quarantined for possible exposure to SARS at a Texas air base. Some of the nine people showed symptoms of the disease and are being treated by medical staff at Dyes Air Force Base. The group passed through Toronto's airport the day after the city was removed from the World Health Organization's list of watch areas. The board investigating the Space Shuttle Columbia accident hopes to report on causes of the tragedy by late next month. The report will include analysis of what one board member calls the smoking gun. In test, a piece of foam insulation fired at a mock shuttle wing smashed a hole in it. During liftoff, Columbia's left wing was hit by a piece of foam. The board has been working with a theory that the craft broke apart after its heat shield was punctured. Coca-Cola, the world's largest soft drink company, announced today that it is being investigated by federal prosecutors looking into allegations of fraud made by a whistleblower lawsuit. A lawsuit filed by a former Coke manager claims the company rigged a marketing test for a new product called Frozen Coke and used slush funds to boost equipment sales. The Securities and Exchange Commission had previously initiated an informal investigation of Coke. On Wall Street at this hour, stocks are higher. The Dow is up 103 at 91.45.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Gail Harris.
It's Here and Now.
To borrow a line from Mark Twain, reports of Catherine Harris's demise have been greatly exaggerated. On Monday, a conspiracy-oriented website reported that the former Florida election secretary turned congresswoman died in a plane crash. Well, she didn't. And her staff spent a lot of time on Tuesday fielding worldwide media inquiries about the false obituary. Which brings us to the question, what can you trust about an obit? Where do they come from? These days, nearly all major daily newspapers have done away with free obituaries, replacing them with paid death notices written by the loved ones of the deceased. So we're asking our editorial roundtable, are obits news or ads? Joining us on the line are Guy McMillan, editorial page editor of the Keene Sentinel in Keene, New Hampshire. Hi, Guy.
Hi, everybody.
And Randy Wilson is editor of the Arizona Daily Sun in Flagstaff, Arizona. Hello, Randy.
Hi, Gail.
So here we are trying to mark the line between paid obits, free obits, death notices. Maybe we should clarify, first of all, these, of course, are some readers' favorite part of the newspaper. There's the news obituary, the paid classified obituary,
And the news obit is written by the news staff, appears in the news sections of the paper, and is usually about someone of some prominence in the community. And so that's free. And then the paid classified obit is priced by the line of text, and it's written by the funeral home or the family. Got that, everybody? So, Randy, how does your paper handle obits?
We're a small paper, and so we regard everybody as newsworthy here in Flagstaff. We also are not inundated like the big metros with 50 to 100 obituaries a day. So we treat them all as news obituaries. We take the information from the family or from the mortuary, rewrite them, and generally try to respect the family's privacy.
But at one point you did have paid death notices, is that right?
We did, and we just found that there were so much testimonials and so much information that was left out, sometimes embarrassing to the family, that we were no longer a paper of record. So we used the news obituaries as a way to really flesh out the history of the town, too.
And, Guy, how do you handle it in Keene, New Hampshire?
Well, we handle it the same way. We consider the obituary to be news, and as news, it has to be handled by the news department. We have tightened up in recent years on the information that we put in the obituary, checking it out with the funeral parlor. We don't take obituaries anymore directly from family members. We had a case some of you may have seen. They made a Lifetime TV movie about it, a woman named Audrey Marie Hilly, who murdered her husband, tried to murder her daughter, then moved to New Hampshire, where she brought into our newspaper her own obituary, announcing that she had died and that she was now her sister. This created some problem for the police trying to track her down. Eventually, they did catch her, and eventually we changed our policy, and we don't take obituaries from people off the street anymore.
I can imagine. It must have really made you question that policy for sure.
Mm. Well, obituaries pose unique decision-making problems for newspapers, and we struggle with that all the time. I mean, what do you put in an obituary if there is negative information about the person, if the person has an ex-wife or a companion or whatever? But we generally try to go with what the family wants, as long as it's accurate.
The biggest sticking point here, and with some newspapers, is now the cause of death. I think the New York Times and others try to insist on that. We really can't get that out of some families, although we try, just as a paper of record again.
In New Hampshire, it takes 7 to 10 days to get that out of the officials, even when the cause of death is a suicide. And as a result, we don't have it in the paper unless it's particularly newsworthy.
Well, and is there a philosophical discussion here, too, in terms of who's the audience? Are you doing this for your general readership, or are you doing this to make the families feel better that there is something in the newspaper that speaks to the passing of someone they loved?
In my mind, there's no question about it. It's the audience is our readership. The family should not be hurt in any gratuitous way, but there may be elements of an obituary that the family disapproves of. And there's nothing in my newspaper, and I venture to say in Randy's, that would prohibit anybody from buying an ad if they'd like, but we're going to write the obituaries ourselves.
But sometimes the reason, though, that I think people take out ads is we call these scrapbook stories. These are the most cut out articles for any newspapers, and families keep these for generations. So if they really want something to say exactly what they want to say, we're happy to let them do it, but they really have to pay for it.
Well, I can tell you, this was my first job as a cub reporter for the Marietta Daily Journal in suburban Atlanta, and it teaches you a real respect for accuracy.
It does, and also the delicacy of dealing with people at difficult times in their lives when you're trying to report a news story. You can't just go barging in and saying, sorry about the death, but,
Exactly. Well, let's talk about what else is making news where you are. Randy, what's the big story in Arizona?
Well, it has to be the heat, Gail. I mean, we're actually baking here. The monsoon rains are at least a week late. It's near record temperatures, 116 down in Phoenix, and there's no air conditioning up in the high country in Flagstaff, so we're just wilting.
And Guy, how about you?
Well, I just told Randy before we began talking on the program that it is raining here in New Hampshire right now, and I didn't want to rub it in, but it is nice and cool outside today.
I think he's rubbing it in, Randy.
Shut them this way.
I think the most fun story for me right now is the presidential primary. I know the rest of the country isn't paying too much attention to who's running for president, but the Democratic candidates are all over New Hampshire, and they come into newspapers and do interviews. And I've often said that I'm not sure that the New Hampshire primary is good for the country, but it's a lot of fun if you're a New Hampshire journalist. I was coming out of the supermarket the other day here in Keene, New Hampshire, and the grocery cart man came up to me, and he said, I want to tell you something. This is not going to be in the media for a while, but I've decided to endorse Howard Dean. And I said, okay. Now, I can't tell you his name because it is not yet, ready for the media. But here's a state where everybody endorses somebody.
Mm. And I understand both of you, both in Arizona and in New Hampshire, are still grappling with some budget issues.
We have a continuing resolution, I guess it's called, trying to make the state continue paying its bills while the legislature, the Republican legislature, fights a deadly battle with the Republican governor. They've accused him of being incompetent. They've accused him of being reckless. But he vetoed the budget that they passed, and the legislature upheld the veto by 4 votes. And now there is a real nasty battle going on, and I don't see where it's going to end.
We've declared a truce here, Guy. The Republicans and the Democrats decided it just wasn't worth fighting over $1 billion, and so they found money to borrow, beg, steal from accounts. And they put the whole thing off for about a year. So we're balanced until next year.
Hmm.
And we've got Howard Dean actually planning to be here Saturday, guys. So we're going to ask him how they do it back east.
You tell him I said hi. He's been in a few times, but we haven't quite made up our mind yet.
Well, gentlemen, thank you both.
Thanks, Gail.
Thank you, Gail.
Randy Wilson is editor of the Arizona Daily Sun in Flagstaff, Arizona. And Guy McMillan is editorial page editor of the Keene Sentinel in Keene, New Hampshire.
Still to come, our reviewers dive into the new thriller, Swimming Pool.
You're listening to Here and Now. Picture this. From a wheat field, a bright, squiggly object rises behind a mountain range, partially blocked by an overhanging cliff. It's a celestial scene that has puzzled art historians for years. Was it a setting sun or a rising moon? And what's the story with that odd-shaped building in the background? Well, a team of astronomers led by Dr. Donald Olson from Southwest Texas State University has now unraveled the mystery behind Vincent van Gogh's 1889 painting titled Evening Landscape with Rising Moon. On July 13th, the 150th anniversary of Van Gogh's birth, Dr. Olson predicts that the moon will appear again, exactly as Van Gogh depicted it, in Saint-Rémy, France. And to further shed some light for us, Stuart Goldman is on the line. He is an associate editor at Sky and Telescope magazine and worked with Dr. Olson on the moon sighting theory. Welcome, Stuart.
Hi, thank you.
Tell us a bit more about this painting. What was it that made this one so mysterious?
Well, it's not really too mysterious. One thing about Van Gogh is his artwork is very well cataloged, and they sort of know about when it was painted, when he was there at the hospital in Saint-Rémy. But what gets the attention of Don Olson is that it obviously showed something celestial. And as astronomers, you see something in a painting or a photograph, and you kind of wonder, is that real? You know, was that something he actually saw? And that's what they wanted to go find out.
Mm. Why do you suppose there was the confusion, though? I mean, he said it was a rising moon. Why do you think they thought it was a setting sun for so long?
Its initial title was Sunset. He didn't really title his own paintings, so they just give him catalog numbers, and the people who drafted the catalogs gave them names. So initially it was Sunset, and then it shortly got changed to Rising Moon. So there obviously was some confusion at one point, and they just wanted to double check.
Well, then how was Dr. Olson able to make this calculation, and why did he want to?
Well, he's had a long-standing tradition with Sky and Telescope magazine and doing these sort of astroforensic projects.
And so this time he and I guess some other people went and stood in the field and what then, did a lot of math?
Yeah, they got some aerial photos and look to see where all landmarks were. Things have changed in 150 years, but they were able to determine, you know, that little overhang that you mentioned that was still there on the cliff in the background. And so they knew it was a real scene, and just based on some trigonometry and some topographic maps and being able to determine precisely the where things are in the sky at night, they were able to pinpoint it very easily.
So what do you think is going to happen on July 13th? Will there be a big crowd standing in the field to see this moon as Van Gogh saw it?
Well, unfortunately, what Dr. Olson and his colleagues discovered is that you really can't get to where he was actually painting it from. But it doesn't matter. You know, you can be in the nearby area and see the same thing, but also, you know, throughout the United States, if you just go out on July 13th, and you'll see the moon, and that's pretty much the same phase and the same part of the sky that Van Gogh saw and painted.
And what do you think about the fact that this sighting will be on the 150th anniversary of Van Gogh's birth?
Yeah, it's a nice little tie-in. This just happened to be a sixth time around in these 19-year cycles, and it just happened to be 150 years after he was born.
Hmm. Well, thank you so much, Stuart.
No, you're very welcome.
Stuart Goldman is an associate editor at Sky and Telescope magazine. And if you'd like to see the Van Gogh painting, you can go to our website at here-now.org.
Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now.
I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
French director François Ozon's first English-language film would seem the perfect summer diversion, with a title like Swimming Pool. The movie's plot is also seasonal. Sarah Morton, the main character played by Charlotte Rampling, is a very successful and very uptight British crime novelist who takes an extended holiday at her publisher's chateau in Provence. But once Sarah shakes the city and begins to settle into the quiet country life, Julie, her publisher's oversexed daughter, arrives, and the plot starts to thicken from then on.
Are you English?
That's correct. I'm Sarah Morton. I'm a writer, and my publisher, John Boslode, is letting me this house.
Oh, so your daddy's latest conquest.
You're his daughter?
So what? Didn't he warn you?
No, he didn't tell me you'd be coming.
I'm not surprised. Is he here?
No, I'm here on my own, and I'm here to work. Maybe he'll come and visit.
I'm glad he's not here.
Are you going to be staying long?
Swimming Pool is a sensual thriller about a mystery writer, which brings us to our guest reviewer this week. Rosemary Herbert is the Boston Herald's book review editor and mystery book review columnist. And she's also author of the new book, Whodunit, A Who's Who in Crime and Mystery Writing. And a very warm welcome, Rosemary.
Thank you for having me.
Rosemary, before we get started on the film, you're currently writing your first mystery novel, aren't you? What's it all about?
Well, it's about an underdog reporter on an underdog newspaper in a two-newspaper town.
Uh-huh. Not autobiographical at all, I'm sure.
No, of course not.
So what did you think of Swimming Pool?
I have to say I was very, very wowed by the director and actress's ability to portray visually something that is such an interior experience. As a writer now of fiction, I felt it absolutely captured what that experience is like. I would never have thought it could have been done visually.
Wow, that's an A. We'll get back to more of your thoughts on the film, but first let's welcome Here and Now's Eric Schaefer.
Hi, Bill.
And Renee Graham.
How are you?
Hi, guys.
Rosemary, you're the mystery expert here. Would you call this a conventional thriller? You seem to suggest it's got a real psychological kind of tone to it.
You've got it exactly right. It is a psychological kind of thriller and not so much a detective story as we know. We're following the action as it develops and, of course, when a criminal activity occurs in it, we are following it and seeing it. There's no question of trying to figure out who done it.
Well, Eric, this is a change in role for British actress Charlotte Rampling, who's been around for a very long time. Her character is repressed and uptight. She doesn't always play characters like that, to say the least.
Right. Charlotte Rampling, I think most people will remember from a lot of her 70s roles like Zardoz and The Night Porter, the very controversial film, Farewell, My Lovely, and The Verdict, where she was often playing sort of a femme fatale, distant but very sexy character.
Right.
And in this particular film, she's playing a middle-aged writer who's very repressed, who's very bottled up in herself, and she does just a marvelous job because when she gets to France and begins to settle in this lovely town, her whole routine is suddenly interrupted and broken up by Julie, the daughter of her publisher, played by Ludivine Sonier, who comes along and she's she's a little sex pot, basically, and this interferes with Sarah's sensibilities.
Listen, Julie, I'm going to be frank with you. I need peace and quiet to concentrate. And since we share the same living space, I must ask you just to go about your business without getting in the way of mine. I mean, this house is certainly big enough for the two of us, so please make an effort. Don't...
I was only trying to be polite and make friends, but if you prefer, I
don't... I don't prefer anything. I just want to work on my book in peace.
Charlotte Rampling, she doesn't need to be sexual in this movie because the actress who plays Julie has enough sexuality for everyone in the film and in the theater, frankly. She's naked through a great deal of the film, and when she's feeling modest, she's only topless. It's a very interesting comparison between these two characters.
How did she do as an actress?
I thought she was very good as an actress. I mean, it's one thing to sort of, you know, traipse around naked or topless, but she has to do more with the character than that. You have to want to get under the skin of this character. Well, no pun intended. So I think she really does pull that off. It's an interesting performance with some really interesting little nuances to it that you start to figure out as the film goes along.
Mm-hmm. Rosemary, the director, Francois Ozon, is quite young, 36 years old. He cites Hitchcock as a big influence. Did you pick up on that? Did you see that?
Absolutely. The first thing that came to mind for me were the Ripley films, of Patricia Highsmith's work, and that uneasiness, that uncertainty of the line between reality and unreality that Highsmith can work with so well, and of course the psychological edginess to it.
The other film that this really sort of reminded me of quite a bit was the 55 Clouseau film, Diabolique. But what's really exceptional about this movie, I think, is the atmosphere. You know, this very sort of sunny, beautiful place, but, you know, there's a real kind of current or undercurrent of loneliness and of alienation that we find in this place that's very sort of unsettling, and that really works to the benefit of the movie.
I think it also works toward portraying the stepping to the side or being beside yourself state of mind of the writer. I always like the expression being beside oneself. Mm-hmm. We think of that in terms of being agitated and upset, but it's the state of mind that a fiction writer is in even when portraying something like the sunshine and someone's complexion.
Well, and she's sort of going through this midlife crisis anyway, and sort of a mid-career crisis. She's been writing these series of detective novels that everybody loves. They make a lot of money, but she's tired of it. She's very bored with her character and wants to move on, wants to try something new. And so the way in which the film kind of captures this sort of mid-career ennui is also really nice.
I don't give a damn about money. Or success. I just want to find...
an inspiring plot.
No, you don't understand. It's got nothing to do with inspiration. I'm fed up with murders and investigations.
Do you like France?
I like frog's legs.
Renee, what about the ending? Does it have a Hitchcockian surprise, maybe somewhat twisted ending to it?
It is a surprise, and because the pace of the film is rather slow. I mean, it really takes its time getting to where it intends to go. I don't know that the ending's going to satisfy everyone. It may feel like a bit of a cheat. And I did have that feeling myself, because you sort of get this feeling you're going someplace and it takes a turn that you don't see coming, which is actually a good thing. It's not predictable at all. At least it wasn't to me. But I'm not sure if that's going to work for everyone.
But it's the trip there, the trip to the end,
that's really interesting
in this movie. I love the way in which we learn about the character, the way we learn about Sarah throughout this movie. It's not driven by dialogue and, you know, what people are saying about her, but it's driven by her actions, these very minute observations on the part of Ozone, the way in which she eats, the way in which she watches other people, how she sits down and begins to write. I mean, that's where the real fascination is in this film.
I agree with that. I liked what Renee said about it taking a turn at the ending, because I often think of detective fiction in terms of being a very form-bound kind of writing, somewhat if you likened it to a sonnet, where you're laying out in those first three quatrains all of the information, however poetically or not, and then suddenly this turn comes and you need to look at everything differently, or perhaps in a kind of askew manner.
Is this a movie you'd go back to, Renee, to try to maybe find things in it you
Definitely.
Didn't find the first time around?
Definitely.
So what's your review?
I did like the film. It really held my interest. I liked these characters. I really found myself getting more and more involved with the Charlotte Rampling character, Sarah Morton, and just what she's going through.
Eric?
Yeah, I do too. And it's such a pleasure to see, you know, a film with an interesting middle-aged character in it. Mm-hmm. That's really quite refreshing.
Yeah, yeah. Who takes her clothes off too, I understand.
Yes, she
yep.
does. just about everybody in this movie.
Just to finish up, Rosemary, I think we already know you like the film, but just briefly, your sort of mini capsule review to finish up.
Well, I think the ending makes things in it that could otherwise have been considered cliched, such as her finally taking a plunge in the pool, have a different look that makes it very successful, even in places where one might have found place for criticism.
The film we've all been talking about, Swimming Pool, Francois Ozone's new film. Our guest reviewer this week was Rosemary Herbert, the Boston Herald's book review editor and mystery book review columnist. She's also author of the new book, Whodunit, A Who's Who in Crime and Mystery Writing. Thanks, Rosemary.
Thank you.
And Eric Schaefer is a film historian who teaches at Emerson College. Thanks, Eric.
Thanks, Bill.
And Renee Graham, pop culture correspondent for the Boston Globe. Thanks a lot, Renee.
Thanks, Bill.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
Our production team includes Andrea Shea, Lynn Menegon, April Peavy, Alan Cockle, Karen Miller-Medson, Lindsay Crudell, and Stefano Katsonis. Our managing editor is Kathleen McKenna.
Vince Fairchild is our engineer. He's assisted by Boris Trepachki and Matt Odette. Our web producer is Zach Christo, and our intern is Allison Vince.
The senior producer of Here and Now is Mark Navin.
I'm Gail Harris. Robin Young is back next week.
I'm Bill Delaney.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software. Information on the web at mathworks.com. MathWorks.com.